the military targeting of hospitals and healthcare workers.
Over the last 5 years, there have been 4,000 incidents documented, and that translates into a facility, a health facility, attacked every 2 days and a health worker killed every 3 days.
That's Leonard Rubinstein. We talk with him about his book, Perilous Medicine, The Struggle to Protect Healthcare from the Violence of War. Then Stan Cox connects the dots between climate chaos, racism, and the next pandemic.
All of this plus economic issues all collided in 2020, and it's not going to be possible to resolve them one at a time. They all need to be resolved together.
We talk with Cox about his book, The Path to a Livable Future. That's all coming up on today's Writer's Voice, in-depth conversation with writers of all genres, on the air since 2004. Thanks for joining us on this station and at writersvoice.net for this, our 797th episode. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. Military violence against hospitals, patients, and health workers has become a common feature of modern war. Think Kosovo, Yemen, Syria, and occupied Palestine. The attacks destroy lives. They also destroy the capacity of health systems to tend to those in need. Yet little is being done about this abomination. That's why my guest Leonard Rubinstein wrote the book Perilous Medicine. A human rights lawyer who's investigated atrocities against healthcare workers around the world, Rubinstein tells of the dangers they face during conflict and the legal, political, and moral struggle to protect them. Leonard Rubinstein, welcome to Writer's Voice.
Thanks so much for having me.
This book, Perilous Medicine, looks at the horrific violence that's often deliberately carried out against healthcare workers and healthcare facilities during war. You first got involved in this issue when you went to Bosnia in the 1990s. Tell us about that, and how did that lead to you writing this book?
I had just started a job with an organization called Physicians for Human Rights that was one of the few groups that tried to document the violence against healthcare. And I went to Bosnia right after the war, and I heard a lot of stories about what had happened, as well as reading reports. And if I can share one story, there was a pediatric hospital in Sarajevo, and the pediatrician in charge was notified just a few minutes ahead that it may well be shelled in a few minutes. And she got the babies who were in incubators out, and they went next door to another hospital, to the basement. But that hospital was also shelled, and it knocked out power, water, electricity, and 9 of the babies died overnight. And that is what opened my eyes to these wrenching kinds of attacks. And in the years subsequent to that, I traveled to other war zones in Chechnya, in the West Bank, in Gaza, and Kosovo, and other places. And the pattern seemed to be clear, although the manifestations were often different. The violence was common, and that's been true ever since. And I felt the world wasn't paying attention either. And so that kind of started me on this journey.
You're right about the world not paying attention, and it's something I think very few people really know about. You know, in 2019, there were at least 1,200 individually documented acts of violence against healthcare facilities and personnel in 20 countries around the world. But this is really just the tip of the iceberg. Talk about the real scope of this problem.
It's the tip of the iceberg in two different senses. One is that in many countries, incidents aren't reported. There are a lot of reasons why they're not reported. It's too dangerous that people who are under such stress of a war don't have time, or they don't believe that it'll do any good to spend their time reporting. So this is a major undercount. But also to put the number into perspective, not the 1,200 number, but we've also learned that Over the last 5 years, there have been 4,000 incidents documented, and that translates into a facility, a health facility, attacked every 2 days and a health worker killed every 3 days. And that leads to the second aspect about the tip of the iceberg, which is that despite these injuries and deaths, those aren't the major consequences, because what happens is that these attacks often destroy future healthcare, whether on an individual level and sometimes a systemic level, whether it's protecting kids from polio and other disease, childhood diseases, or having safe childbirth years afterward, after the attacks, the morbidity and mortality continue. So the ramifications are just enormous.
One example of that you give in the book, which we will also return to a little bit later, is Yemen, which saw, what was it, the largest outbreak of cholera ever recorded? Talk about how that came about.
During the war, the Saudi-led coalition, particularly Saudi Arabia itself, in its war against the Houthis in Yemen, which started in 2015, indiscriminately bombed. They took no care, as they were supposed to do, to distinguish between military and civilian objects. And they destroyed many hospitals and basically an already weak health system. And they also bombed water and sanitation facilities. So there was no clean water in Yemen to speak of, unless it was brought in by truck. And that led to 2 million people getting cholera. And we think of cholera in Haiti or Somalia, but that outbreak was like 20 times bigger than anything in recent years. And that's what you see. You see destruction of systems with consequences for people who are far away, sometimes far away in time. That wasn't the case in Yemen, but in some cases it is.
What are some of the different factors that tend to drive these attacks? I mean, you just mentioned, you know, there was indiscriminate bombing, but there's also targeted bombing. So what are the factors that cause these atrocities?
One of the things I've been trying to understand over the years and what I grappled with in writing the book is to understand why these are happening. After all, the law has prohibited these kinds of attacks for the last 150 years. So what is driving these? And what I concluded is that combatants have military objectives and that they act in accordance with those objectives, and attacking healthcare in various ways can advance those objectives. In Syria, there's been strategic bombing against health facilities and killing of almost 1,000 health workers, basically as a way of forcing populations to move, displacing them, showing populations that supporting rebel groups will just cause more pain, and advancing a particular military campaign. So that's strategic. It's sometimes tactical. It's very simple, where a hospital is a good place to fire a rocket or guns because of its geographic location or because it has supplies that combatants want. And a third, and one of the most common, is that despite the law that says everyone is entitled to equal care if you're wounded or sick, and combatants must be impartial in how they treat wounded people because they're not in combat anymore, people don't like enemies to be treated, whether those enemies are wounded combatants or people who are treating them. So there are campaigns against both the people who are sick or wounded and their caregivers in many countries. So those are three reasons. There are others.
You know, one of the things, Leonard Rubinstein, that I found so interesting, I mean, aside from the amazing stories you tell in this book, Perilous Medicine, is the development of the very concepts that undergird the Geneva Conventions, or the idea that medical workers should not be targeted. and contradictory, you know, contradictory notions. You write about the development of the idea of the humanitarian limits on warfare, and you focus in on two figures from the 19th century, Francis Lieber and Henri Dunant. They took very different tacks on the issue that have influenced, you know, where we are today. So tease out that story for us.
Sure. Amazingly, they both were very active in the 1860s, very same decade. And Dunant witnessed a terrible battle in northern Italy where wounded soldiers were just left lying on the battlefield, desperately hurt, dying of thirst, and just in terrible suffering. And he couldn't believe that no one was coming to their aid, and no one was, because those people could be shot if they went out to help them. And so he wrote a famous book, one as famous there as Harriet Beecher Stowe's book here in the same period, and said, we need to care for wounded soldiers. And principles of humanity apply, that these people are human beings and they need to be dealt with as other human beings. And that led to the first Geneva Convention in 1864, which set that as a rule and extended it to protection of hospitals and healthcare workers. And over the last 150 years, that principle and those laws have gotten only stronger over time. So all over the world, these principles of protection of healthcare are reaffirmed. They're based in the law, and there are international treaties like the convention saying so. But at the same time, as Dunant was writing, there was a contrary view that Francis Lieber was advocating, that while cruelty in war should be forbidden, if it was required to breach the rules of protection of civilians or healthcare, in order to win a just war more quickly, it was acceptable to attack them. And he advocated that that's become the rule of military necessity. That was rejected and has been rejected time and again in international law. But interestingly, he incorporated those ideas into a code that Abraham Lincoln adopted for the Union Army just before the Battle of Gettysburg, and has been influential ever since. And when you look at his reasoning, it's not hard to grasp that combatants would think that they're justified in attacking healthcare, because in their minds, their war is just, and in their minds, it might help end the war more quickly. So it's incredibly open-ended. And one of the things I tried to do in this book is explain this contrasting set of norms and how we have one norms in the law, but another set of norms apparently in people's conduct.
Yeah, I mean, that was the excuse given for dropping the bombs on Hiroshima and Nagasaki, although that's not an argument that I accede to, especially in light of the fact that Japan was already suing for peace before then. But, you know, it just shows the kind of horrific consequences when you fudge the line, when you say, you know, for humanitarian reasons, we're going to destroy the enemy.
What's interesting is that these days, the Lieber view of necessity as a justification is rarely articulated, but yet we still see it. For example, in counterterrorism law, where, as I said a moment ago, the idea that everybody is entitled to treatment if they're wounded or sick, and nobody should be punished for providing it, counterterrorism law criminalizes healthcare to someone the government deems a terrorist, which is completely contrary to the Geneva Conventions, but is justified because of the fight against terrorism. So we see how those ideas seep in to practices not only of rogue states or rogue armed groups, but in the practice of countries and the policies of countries that purport to be devoted to international law and the Geneva Conventions.
And could you talk about that specifically with the United States? Because I found, you know, there were some really compelling cases there of, you know, a doctor who was denied asylum in this country. And where was that? There was one case in Turkey.
In Nepal.
Yes, in Nepal. Exactly. Tell us the story rather than me trying to tell it for you.
If you don't mind, I'll give you a little background because the situation changed. I mentioned going to Chechnya, and there was a doctor there who was treating both wounded Russian soldiers and Chechen rebel combatants, and each side went after him because he was treating the other side. And he ended up coming to the United States and getting asylum. But after 9/11, the situation really changed as counterterrorism became such a major foreign policy objective. And then a case arose where a medic in Nepal had been kidnapped by Maoist rebels, as they often did, to provide care to the cadres who needed medical care. He eventually escaped, but when he got back home, the government went after him for having treated Maoists. He managed to get out and come to the United States, and he was denied his claim for asylum because he had provided care to a terrorist or a terrorist organization or on behalf of a terrorist organization, even though he was compelled by being kidnapped to do so. The story had a happy ending in that he was allowed under a different provision to get asylum. But the immigration court said, well, the provisions of the Geneva Convention are not relevant here because our counterterrorism law is what applies. So we see this, and that is part of the checkered record of this country. On the one hand, a champion of human rights and the Geneva Conventions in many circumstances, but engaging in actions that contravene or undermine them in other circumstances.
Yeah, like imprisoning people without charge for 20 years in Guantanamo. But you also say that counterterrorism law is not only, let's say, unfair and counter to the Geneva Conventions, but it's also irrational and counterproductive. Explain.
You just have to think about it. I think you have to think of the premise that you're going along a very long logical chain. That is that if someone who is wounded, who has any connection whatsoever with a terrorist organization, and you provide that care, maybe they might in the future commit a terrorist act and kill people. It's a chain of logic which you can follow, but there's no empirical basis for believing that has any reality. And of course, it's also applied so broadly that it's not restricted to people who are, as the Bush administration officials used to say, the worst of the worst, but it's applied categorically. And we saw that, you mentioned Guantanamo. We've seen that too, where the dragnet swept everybody in, whether they were an innocent farmer or driver or a terrorist, because the law is applied so broadly that you don't make distinctions. So it isn't rational. And there's no evidence that this kind of rule of punishing a doctor is going to stop a terrorist attack. It doesn't seem very likely.
Yeah, exactly. And then there's another issue that comes up is kind of the debate within the humanitarian and donor community about the role of neutrality in aid work. You have the example in Myanmar of some aid organizations that refused to support a group called Backpack because Backpack was supporting the pro-democracy movement, and so they claimed that it was political. This seems really bizarre. So tell us about this story and that larger debate that it points to.
It's bizarre, but it's all too common. It's common because in places like Myanmar, where in a war in the eastern part of country where oppressed ethnic groups were trying to gain some autonomy, there was a military wing to their groups. And the Burmese military responded with complete brutality, displacing local populations, attacking civilians, and would not allow humanitarian groups to go in to provide care for civilians. And so indigenous groups began to provide that care. And they were, the one group you mentioned, the backpack health workers, were identified with the ethnic groups. And so some people were concerned that they weren't doing their job because they were acting politically. The idea that someone who is offering medical care to someone is engaged in a political act is extremely problematic, especially when you say it's prohibited, because they're acting appropriately from a medical standpoint, they're acting ethically, and their political affiliations are separate from their medical work. And the same is true in Syria, where basically everyone living in an opposition-controlled area, every human being and every physician, nurse, and other person just living there is deemed to be an enemy because it's occupied by the opposing forces. And these are people who are themselves under attack. So again, this makes no logical sense, but it's very powerful as an ideology that they're not showing an expected neutrality, which the law doesn't require and shouldn't.
If you've just joined Writer's Voice, we're talking with Leonard Rubinstein about his book, Perilous Medicine, The Struggle to Protect Healthcare from the Violence of War. Let's go back to the Geneva Convention. The first Geneva Conventions protected soldiers wounded in battle and their caregivers, but it didn't protect civilians from attack, nor did it stop the kind of bombing that we saw in Dresden or Hiroshima or the London Blitz, for that matter. How did the Geneva Conventions change after World War II, and do they protect civilians and their caregivers from that kind of bombing now?
In the aftermath of World War II, the Geneva Conventions were changed because all of the atrocities that happened during the war. And so they were extended to protection of civilians. But what wasn't done was to stop strategic bombing. The United States was the only possessor of a nuclear weapon, and no one, neither the British nor the United States, wanted any kind of retrospective judgment on their conduct in the bombing of Germany and, of course, Japan. So there was no prohibition on indiscriminate bombing or strategic bombing after the Second World War. And that led to Korea, where 18 cities were destroyed, probably a million people were killed, probably 1,000 hospitals were destroyed, we don't know for sure. And then Vietnam, where we all know about the napalm and the cluster bombs and the defoliants and all kinds of other horrors inflicted both in Vietnam and Cambodia, and actually in Laos too. It was after Vietnam in 1977 that the conventions were finally amended to prohibit any attack that doesn't distinguish between civilians and military objects. And that's actually had a good effect, although there are still thousands of violations. The prohibition on strategic bombing has had an impact, not in Syria, where hospitals are targets, but at least among a lot of countries. So we don't see the kind of civilian casualty numbers, which in the past had numbered in the hundreds of thousands or even millions. Now, despite the fact that there shouldn't be any such casualties of civilians, it's gone way down. So that has been a positive impact of the conventions. It's just so much more work to do.
The U.S. is a signatory of the Geneva Conventions. Isn't that correct?
Yes, it did not ratify the 1977 changes, but it agrees to be bound by the provisions that require distinguishing civilian and military objects, and the requirement that attacks have to be proportional in the sense that you have to take account civilian casualties when you launch an attack. So even though we didn't ratify them, they are considered binding.
So wouldn't this outlaw nuclear war?
Yes, it would. But as in so many circumstances, the United States government is not willing to take that position formally.
Talk also about the Israel-Palestine conflict, the occupation of Palestinian territory. You have a chapter which talks about checkpoints and the violence against ambulances. Talk a little bit about what's been going on there.
Yeah. I chose to write about the problem of medical evacuation and ambulance safety at checkpoints because the record in Israel is more extensive than anywhere else. And for a time, they actually tried to address it. It's a problem that is true around the world. And some thinkers or writers speculate that more people die at checkpoints because they can't get through than do in hospital bombings around the world. And in Israel, this has been an issue for at least 20 or 30 years during the occupation, when there have been flare-ups in violence, as we've seen so often in Gaza, sometimes in the West Bank, and also in the routine dimensions of occupation, where Palestinian movement is constrained. You're supposed to have provisions that allow people to get through checkpoints and to be medically evacuated during combat so they can get to care. And back in 2002, when I went during the second intifada, five medics had been killed by Israelis in about 2 or 3 weeks. We went to the West Bank in Gaza in 2002 because five medics had been killed in 2 or 3 weeks by the Israeli army. And it turned out that there are procedures that combatants can have to inspect ambulances to make sure they're not carrying weapons. But even after Palestinian ambulances had been inspected, they were still shot at and people were killed. There was an outcry both internationally and domestically about these and related events. And Israel instituted some reforms which worked for a while. But over time, their commitment to these reforms dissipated, and we saw that in Gaza, where many, many more people were killed or died because they weren't evacuated. And at the same time, the regime of checkpoints, both between Israel and the West Bank and within the West Bank, expanded to dozens and hundreds eventually. And people have been deterred from reaching routine care for childbirth, for chronic disease. And we know that many babies have been born at checkpoints. Mothers have died giving birth at checkpoints. So it's an enormous and solvable problem, but it remains not solved, both in Israel and in other places in the world.
Now, in 2016, the UN Security Council adopted a resolution that specifically laid out a path for the protection of health workers in war. Tell us about that resolution and where does it stand today?
That resolution came about after there was an airstrike by a U.S. fighter, a Doctors Without Borders hospital in Afghanistan. It was a modern new hospital, served thousands of trauma patients every year, was incredibly valued by the population for hundreds of kilometers around. And as the attack was going forward, the Doctors Without Borders staff were frantically calling the military and their contacts to say, stop this. This is a mistake, or this is wrong, but the messages didn't get through. There was an investigation. It showed that there were multiple layers of negligence and dereliction of duty. It was not intentionally targeted at the hospital, but many mistakes and an absence of required actions as precautions were not taken. Because it was such a dramatic attack and it was conducted by the United States. It stimulated attention around the world and eventually a resolution the following year at the UN Security Council. And it was a very strong resolution, not only condemning attacks, but demanding that governments take various actions to reform their military practices and hold perpetrators to account. And they all agreed to it. It was passed unanimously, and like 80 or 90 co-sponsors. And yet 5 years later, there's been virtually no action to adhere to this resolution, that governments haven't acted as they should to engage in the reforms. There's still impunity and absence of accountability, as the resolution called for. So in a way, it was a milestone, but it was a problematic milestone in that it was another rhetorical assertion of belief in the Geneva Conventions, but it wasn't followed by action.
As Greta Thunberg would say, it's blah, blah, blah.
Unfortunately, yes, although we're not giving up.
Yeah, and in fact, you do feel that there's some reason for hope in this book, Leonard Rubinstein, in Perilous Medicine. What can be done? How can governments and other combatants be pressured to stop attacking the healthcare workers?
Well, one of the reasons I decided to write the book was because I think there has to be more of a demand to stop this, a demand by the citizenry, and particularly a demand by members of the health professions, doctors, nurses, public health officials. And there has to be solidarity with the people who are out there working in these incredibly difficult and violent circumstances, making terribly difficult decisions, suffering trauma, not only the trauma, the violence, but the what we call moral distress of not being able to do your job when you think you have an obligation to do it. So we have to raise the visibility and make a social demand. And there are very many concrete steps that can be taken, whether it's a country that's at war, where ministries of health can get more involved, or countries like the United States, where our influence on military practice around the world is enormous. For example, I mentioned the war in Yemen and the indiscriminate bombing by the Saudis. Well, that was enabled in part by enormous U.S. arms sales to the Saudis, which enabled these attacks to take place, including mid-air refueling and other military forms of support, as well as the arms. There are also reforms in military operational practice in the field that could be undertaken. And Congress actually required the Defense Department to do that in a defense bill last year, although there hasn't been a lot of action on that to date. And there can be more accountability. We have institutions of accountability, but governments use their political clout to prevent accountability, not only for their own actions, but for the actions of allies. So we have to change the dynamic. And I think it can be changed in the way finally this use of strategic bombing became unacceptable. And you can't really talk about that without talking about the anti-war movement against Vietnam, where it not only had an impact at home, but it actually led to changes in international law. So we have a lot to do, and it won't happen unless we do it.
Well, and as someone who got my start in politics in that anti-Vietnam War movement, I'm very glad to hear that it led to some changes in international law. Leonard Rubinstein, your book is Perilous Medicine, The Struggle to Protect Healthcare from the Violence of War. It is such an important book, very compellingly written, with a lot of amazing stories in it. I highly recommend it to my listeners. And thank you so much for joining us here.
And thanks so much for having me.
Leonard Rubinstein is professor and director of the Program on Human Rights and Health in Conflict at Johns Hopkins Bloomberg School of Public Health. He founded the Safeguarding Health in Conflict Coalition and is a former president of Physicians for Human Rights. Go to writersvoice.net for links to more information about his work. Next up, the path to a livable future. Stay tuned after the break. That was Greta's song by The Sweet Janes. Welcome back to Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. 2020 was a year defined by crisis. For decades, scientists have been sounding the alarm about the urgency of addressing climate change. But it took COVID-19 to show that the future of human life on Earth is interconnected and at risk. While the virus spread quickly across the globe, extreme weather events compounded the suffering, and in the U.S., outrage over the murder of George Floyd expanded to include a growing awareness of the pandemic's disproportionate impact on communities of color. In The Path to a Livable Future, Stan Cox makes plain the connections between the multiple crises facing us today, and he provides a vision for how to resolve them. Stan Cox, welcome to Writer's Voice.
It's great to be with you.
Your book, The Path to a Livable Future, delves into the link between climate change, environmental racism. I wonder if you could explain the links between these three crises.
All of this plus economic issues all collided in 2020. And it's not going to be possible to resolve them one at a time. They all need to be resolved together. You know, we heard a lot during 2020 about how you can't bring the economy back unless the pandemic is addressed. But at the same time, neither the pandemic nor the climate emergency, which didn't go away, neither of those can be addressed until we both stop ecological degradation, which is driving both of those things, and systemic racism, which, because the consequences of both the pandemic and climate chaos have hit marginalized communities and people of color harder than anyone else.
I wonder if you could spell out a little bit more the link why we can't adequately tackle the climate emergency without tackling systemic racism.
When you look at studies of the impacts of climate, you know, for example, heat waves, which we've seen have become more frequent and severe every year, in neighborhoods that have been subjected to redlining from the 1930s to the 60s, that is the practice of denying mortgages or denying affordable mortgages to Black Americans who lived in, well, to all the people who lived in certain neighborhoods that were predominantly Black. Those neighborhoods have never recovered economically or physically from that redlining era. And in fact, a study came out during 2020 showing that the average temperature during summer in redlined neighborhoods was 7 to 10 degrees or 12 degrees warmer than in other corresponding neighborhoods in other parts of the city. That's because of having far too little green space or far too few trees and far too much concrete. Also, neighborhoods that are subject to flooding more because there's too much paving and not enough drainage also tend to be where people of color are living.
But I'm going to stop you there because, I get that. that communities of Black and brown poor people, and also, let's be clear, also, there are plenty of white folks who are poor also, and their neighborhoods are also affected. You know, so there are class issues here. They're disproportionately affected, but why can't we you could say, and I'm not espousing this, but you could say, well, these are just sacrifice zones. You know, we can solve the climate crisis without taking care of these people. Why is it important to everybody that these issues of environmental racism, environmental classism get tackled in order for us all to solve the climate crisis?
Well, to solve the climate crisis, our major task is to take down the fossil fuel industries and to end as quickly as possible the burning of fossil fuels. And as a model for doing that, we can look to the environmental justice movement, and they have been at this a long time, trying to keep polluting industries and most prominently fossil fuel related industries and power plants out of predominantly Black neighborhoods. You know, since the 1970s, this has been a very strong movement. And the interest of those of us who are fortunate enough not to live with those industries are perfectly aligned with the goals of the environmental justice movement. The other inspiration that we can take and a proven record on both climate and human rights are the movements of the First Nations who have been in the forefront of the climate movement in stopping the construction of pipelines across their lands and in forcing, for example, the shutdown of the Navajo generating station on Navajo lands. In 2019, it finally got shut down because of the struggle of Indigenous people there.
And which was a huge thing to happen. That was like one of the biggest coal plants, I think, in the country, if not the world.
Yeah.
And, you know, we also have Line 3, the fight against that, the DAPL Dakota Access Pipeline. All of those are definitely examples of that. You say that we face a fork in the road, that we can have ecological sustainability, that is survival, or we can have capital accumulation, but not both. So you're really talking about saying that basically we cannot have capitalism as it is today and still survive.
You can see evidence for this either looking backward or looking forward. Looking backward, we can see that for every increment of new economic growth, and you know, economic growth is exponential. If you have growth of 3%, that means 3% of the previous year. So growth is an accelerating thing, and consumption of energy and other material resources it accelerates right along with economic growth, and this idea that you can decouple the two isn't working. But you can look at the flip side of that. If what we need to do in order to put the brakes on the climate emergency is to very quickly and directly reduce the quantities of fossil fuels that are coming out of the ground and into the economy. And if we do succeed in doing that, it's not going to be very good for business, not just the fossil fuel industries, but it will require very careful allocation of the energy and materials that we do have to meeting human needs and not to overproduction that we have today in the production of superfluous goods and services, because we're going to be living with a shrinking energy supply. Even as we build up renewable energy, it's not going to build up as fast. And that is not a situation that capitalism can thrive in. Without growth, capitalism isn't capitalism.
You know, it's interesting because I think that there's a controversy around this issue. You very clearly say we need to decrease energy use, not just make it cleaner. But I recently spoke with Saul Griffith, who wrote the book Electrify, who says that this downer message, he doesn't call it a downer message, but, you know, will make it politically impossible to tackle climate change. And he says if all households were helped to electrify everything, because electricity use is so much more efficient than fossil fuel use, it would, in fact, decrease overall energy usage and also maintain the modern standard of living. What are your thoughts on that?
That is the, a very common answer to this. And I think there is a tendency to not want to go all the way and say, what the world is going to be like without fossil fuels. And I'm all for electrification because the only industrial energy we can produce, if it's not from fossil fuels, is various means of solar, wind power, hydroelectric of producing electricity. And sure, an electric vehicle is more efficient than an internal combustion engine, but we're not going to replace a quarter billion vehicles in this country, replace them all with electric vehicles and solve the ecological emergency we face. First of all, there is the huge input of mineral resources, most of them in under the soil of other countries that's required for this. And then there are many other reasons that we are not going to replicate the kind of world we see around us today in affluent America without fossil fuels. And if we keep trying to replicate it with fossil fuels, it's going to come down. So I agree that it's not a very politically soothing message. But I think that if we do tell people, look, your life is going to be just the same, just different forms of energy, and you'll be able to carry on. And once it becomes apparent that that's not possible, then it's going to be really difficult to say, well, of course it wasn't possible, but we had to get legislation passed or whatever. So I've been trying to go out and plant a flag at the spot where, that's how far we have to go to get this under control. And so, we can take steps toward that, but we have to always be clear that, what we've done is a step toward that. We can't stop here, and we got to take those steps very rapidly at this point.
Well, yeah. I mean, unfortunately, I think that the political will is absolutely critical to do that. And so it's really a conundrum. I tell people that the Europeans have a very high standard of living, but they use about half of the energy that we do in this country, so that there are ways to live well with using less energy. And I think if you tell people that they can't do something, you're going to lose them. You have to tell them what they can do and that it actually will be as good, if not better.
Yeah, right. I mean, I'd like to do that also. I use Croatia, which uses one-fourth as much energy as we do per capita. And I've been there a number of times in the past. It's a perfectly livable place. So it's not necessary to use all that much energy. And I think the people in the degrowth movement are very good at portraying these visions of the future and how life can actually be better without all of the stuff we're surrounded by now that was a creation of the fossil fuel bonanza.
So continuing on this subject, Stan Cox, in this book, The Path to a Livable Future, A New Politics to Fight Climate Change, Racism, and the Next Pandemic, you talk about rationing, another explosive, word, cap and adapt. Tell us about rationing, how it needs to be done. And then I'm going to follow up with asking you again, kind of, how do we work this in a way to gain the support of a broad base coalition of people in this country, rather than alienating them?
Yes, rationing. I wrote a whole book about that and have always struggled in trying to explain. I think rationing is misunderstood. It's thought of as a way for the government to suppress consumption. But that's not what it is. It's a way in a situation of resource scarcity or reduced input of resources, it's a way to ensure sufficiency and fairness for everyone, that nobody is going without and nobody is excessively consuming and depriving other people. And the reason that rationing will be in our future, if we do take effective action against climate change, is that I believe what is an absolute requirement is, as you mentioned, for shorthand, my colleague and I have called cap and adapt, which means putting an impermeable cap on the number of barrels of oil, cubic feet of gas, and tons of coal that can come out of the ground and into the economy each year, and then ratcheting that cap down very quickly by the kind of deadlines that the UN and IPCC, talking about now, within, 15 years, maybe, driving that down to zero. That will create a situation in which, at a minimum, energy is going to have to be allocated among the economic sectors to make sure that all necessities are produced and essential goods and services. But it also will mean that in the consumer energy market, that first of all, there will have to be price controls, because you can imagine what the price of a gallon of gas would go to if left uncontrolled and under those circumstances. So it'll require price controls. But then to ensure fairness and to ensure that you don't have social strife and conflict and huge mile-long lines of cars at the gas station or grocery store, that system of rationing, it could maybe be given a less scary name, but that such a system be implemented.
Maybe call it equitable sharing.
Yeah, I always usually use the term fair shares rationing. And that was the way it was sold in the 1940s in the U.S., U.K., Canada. We had this very thing because so much of the resources and energy were walled off in order to go to the war effort. The civilian economy adapted essentially just what I've been talking about. There was the so-called War Production Board, which they decided, okay, we're not going to make personal vehicles this year. Those factories have to make tanks. Of course, we're not going to be making tanks, but in what I'm envisioning. And then you had a rationing system for a number of goods, but most prominently, gasoline and heating oil, and then, of course, food. Some meat and other food products. And it worked very well. It was carried out by local rationing boards, members of the community who distributed the ration coupons and so forth. And polls showed that people instead of complaining about rationing, they were saying, yeah, you need to also ration, overcoats or something. Yeah, they were seeing that there were goods that were in short supply that weren't being rationed, and they wanted to see even more rationing for, at least while the war was going on.
But of course, while we had capitalism back in the 1940s, we didn't have neoliberal capitalism in the way we have now. You talk about the need to nationalize fossil fuels. And, I have to say, I think we're going to have a new religion, because I don't see any of these things happening, when we have just seen what's happened with the likes of of Joe Manchin and Kyrsten Sinema and the gridlock in the Congress and the Joe Biden talking out of two sides of his mouth when it comes to climate, on the one hand, talking about renewable energy and clean energy, and on the other hand, permitting new pipelines, gas and oil infrastructure. So I guess I'll set aside the question of how are we going to get to nationalizing these fossil fuels, but why? Why do we need to nationalize fossil fuels in the drive for a clean energy economy?
If we do what's necessary with climate, that is to end the extraction and burning of fossil fuels, then I'm almost certain that the companies involved are not going to accept a business model, in the goal of which is to put themselves out of business. And so I can envision them being bought out cheaply and reform into public cooperatives and also privatizing. Well, much of our electric power utilities are already public, but they would also need to be public. And this also, like rationing, is not something that's alien to this country. During every war that we've fought since World War II, the government has taken over industries because of national emergency. In the 1980s, more than 1,000 savings and loans were taken over by the government because of the scandals and collapses that were happening there. And many of the oil-producing countries have their fossil fuel industries are publicly owned.
I also spoke about this kind of idea with Saul Griffith. He didn't call it nationalization, but actually it certainly is. And I thought he had a very good suggestion, which I'll just repeat here, which is that in buying out these companies, the monies given to them to buy them out would have to go to investing in clean energy technology. So the companies themselves would not go away, but they would have to become clean energy companies instead of fossil fuel companies. What's your thought on that?
Yeah, that's an excellent idea. And the government could tell them, direct them to do that. Okay, you've got to invest that money in renewable energy. And so if you're not willing to do that, then you don't get any money, because your reserves of oil, gas, and coal, because of this cap and adapt program, the value of the bulk of those reserves is now zero, because they can never be let out of the ground. So those aren't stranded assets. Those are now worthless assets.
Well, Stan Cox, thank you so much for talking with us here on Writer's Voice. Your book, The Path to a Livable Future, really spells out exactly what needs to happen for us to have a livable future.
Thank you so much.
Stan Cox is the author of many books, including The Green New Deal and Beyond. He works for the Land Institute in Kansas. That's it this week for Writer's Voice. Listen again for free, read book excerpts, and sign up for the podcast at writersvoice.net. I'm Francesca Rhiannon.